You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
To be an effective U.S. Secretary of State, you've got to have a tremendous store of intelligence, patience, and drive. And according to Madeleine Albright, the first woman to ever hold the post, you can also benefit from a large collection of decorative pins. She used her brooches as diplomatic tools while serving in the Clinton administration to signal her mood or her goals for a meeting, a bright sun to symbolize hope, a crab to show that she was being frustrated. Madeleine Albright was on the show last September to discuss Read My Pins, her book which looks at her life and career through the filter of her pin collection, and we thought that we would rebroadcast that conversation on this extended holiday weekend. I began by asking her, was her title, Read My Pins, a play on the first President Bush's famous phrase, Read My Lips?
Well, it actually came from that. What happened, the whole thing happened, believe it or not, because of Saddam Hussein. He called me an unparalleled serpent, and I was ambassador at the United Nations, and I wore a snake pin that I had. And so I decided that it was fun to signal, and at that stage, President Bush had said, read my lips, just before, and I thought, well, when people want to know what we were going to do, I said, read my pins. So I credit him with the title.
And were people actually reading your pins?
Well, they ultimately did, which is so funny, because I was really having fun, and people began to understand that there was something going on. And, for instance, later, when I was negotiating the anti-ballistic missile treaty with the Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov, I had on a pin that kind of looks like an arrow, but he said, is that one of your interceptors? And I said, yes, and we make them very small, so let's negotiate.
Well, haven't flag lapel pins been de rigueur in American politics for years? Barack Obama was even criticized for not wearing one during the presidential campaign. But this is different because you don't have to wear the flag every day.
No, and I comment on this. You know, I think in totalitarian countries, I was in North Korea, everybody has to wear a pin of the dear leader, or in China, Mao Zedong. So I don't think that we need to tell people to wear pins. And so I found the arguments about Barack Obama not wearing a flag pin totally absurd. But I wear pins when I love my Americana pins, and I wear them when it's suitable.
Well, in your case, are the pins a female version of a man's tie, which men often choose their ties to send a message, usually about power or establishment networking?
In some ways, I think they are. And also, they are a similar door opener because, believe it or not, when world leaders get together, they have to begin the conversation in some way. And often they would say, really like your tie. And so it's just an icebreaker.
Had you always worn pins before
No.
you started sending messages with them?
Well, I clearly like jewelry. So I had bought some pins and I wore some, you know, like most girls in the 50s. I had a circle pin that we all had. I had a fraternity pin. And I had a couple of other pins, but it didn't occur to me. And there was no strategic plan to this. I just was having fun.
Well, did you already own a snake pin when you
I
put
did.
That one on?
That was one I actually had. I had bought it because I thought it was very interesting. It was an antique pin. And I never thought that it would be the beginning of this trend. But it suited the purpose, and that's how it began.
And did Saddam Hussein or somebody in his government get the message?
I don't know. I really don't know. But it seemed like a good way to message back after he had called me this unparalleled serpent.
And then you wore a bug pin to meet with the Soviets?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. Again, this was, and they got that too. What happened is that the Russians had actually bugged the State Department. We found a bug in one of our conference rooms that there had been somebody listening to us. So the next time I met with the Russians, I wore this huge bug, and there was no question that they noticed it.
But you have a wide range of bug pins, don't you?
I have a lot of I have a menagerie, and I have a lot of spiders and bugs, and I have some, you know, butterflies and various things.
And ladybugs.
Ladybugs.
Which is meant to be pleasant, I
Always
assume.
Happy time with ladybugs.
And you also have a triple monkey pin.
Well, I'll tell you what happened there. There's a very funny picture in the book. We were having the 50th anniversary of NATO, and President Clinton and Bill Cohen and I were sitting on a sofa, and Diana Walker came in to take a picture, and we'd been talking about something, and President Clinton thought we should not be talking in front of a journalist, so he put his hand over his mouth, and then spontaneously somehow Bill Cohen put his hands over his ears, and I put my hands over my eyes. And so we had the hear no evil, see no evil. And then what happened was I was able actually to find three monkeys. And when President Clinton and I went to Russia for the summit, I so disapproved of what the Russians were doing in Chechnya that they kept saying nothing was going on. So I wore my three monkeys then. And President Putin actually commented on the fact that they were always interested in what pins I wore.
And try to read that. That's like Kremlinologists in this country. We had pinologists in the
pinologists
in Russia.
And my pin diplomacy.
Yeah. I'm assuming that not only were you the first woman to become Secretary of State in the United States, but also the first one to use pins to make a political statement.
I imagine I was. Although I have to tell you, what was fun in doing this book, I went back and I looked a little bit at the history of jewelry. And I'm clearly not the first person that signaled things with jewelry. Mostly it had been men before in terms of very elaborate necklaces and various things. And pins began for people to keep their clothes on. So, I'm not new.
But you also talk about Cleopatra's pearl.
That is a great story. I think Cleopatra and Mark Antony, I call them the first power couple, and he had bet her that, or she bet him, that she could serve him in the most expensive meal in the world. So apparently they had something fairly ordinary, and he said, well, this isn't very expensive. So what happened is she ordered up a cup of vinegar, and then she took off her perfect pearl earring and dropped it into the vinegar, and it disintegrated. So that was kind of...
So that was a diplomatic use of jewelry.
I guess it was, yes.
And then, of course, there was wampum in the trade between
right.
Europeans and Native Americans. And that was jewelry being used as...
in some particular way, absolutely. And it's very interesting. I mean, crowns, if you think about it, and the crown jewels in England and various ways that people signaled. But my pins are really, most of them are costume jewelry.
So we're not using real diamonds and precious metals here.
There's one or two, but not really a lot. And what has made it so much fun, I was so thrilled. The David McFadden, who is at the Museum of Arts and Design, where my pins are now exhibited, wrote the introduction to my book. And it's lovely, but the thing that I really appreciated most is he said it was the most democratic, small d, collection he'd seen, because it really is of costume jewelry that I picked up at flea markets and things, and anybody can have fun like this.
Well, you're wearing an eagle pin right now, and it is sure glittering.
Well, but...
Are those all rhinestones?
Mostly, yes. They are rhinestones.
Is this the famous eagle
pin?
No,
this is not the famous eagle pin. This is a pin made for me by a wonderful artist in New Mexico, Carol Sarkissian. My famous eagle pin is on the cover of my Madam Secretary book, and the story there was that I went to a jewelry store, and they showed me this amazing eagle pin, and I thought, well, I really can't have this pin, and it was just about the time that my name was on a list for being Secretary of State. I never believed I was going to be Secretary of State. And I thought to myself, if by some miracle I become Secretary of State, I'm going to come back and get this pin. And that's what I had.
Now, why didn't you think you'd be named Secretary of State? Simply because you were a woman?
Yes.
Because it's a logical step often to go from the UN to state, isn't it?
No, I was the first one that happened to. But I think I have to tell you, there were real questions as to whether a woman could be Secretary of State. And there were issues as to whether the Arab leaders, for instance, would deal with a woman Secretary of State. And what happened was the Arab ambassadors at the UN kind of got together and said, we've dealt with Ambassador Albright. That's not a problem. I really didn't think it would happen. And it did happen because I think President Clinton wanted to make it happen, and because Hillary Clinton said that it would really make a difference.
Of course, when you look at leaders around the world, women have led many countries. We are the only country that I can think of real importance that hasn't had a woman at one point or another. I guess France as well. although there is an argument being made for Carla Bruni. But Germany, Angela Merkel, of course, Margaret Thatcher in England, Golda Meir.
Gro Brundtland in Norway, a lot of places.
And all throughout Asia.
Right.
And so I would think that it would have been expected that a woman could rise to that kind of a level of diplomacy.
It seems hard to believe, but we think we're number one in everything. We are not in this particular issue. And so I was surprised. I genuinely was surprised and obviously very pleased. I have to tell you, I have a granddaughter who just turned 7, and she said, "So what's the big deal about Grandma Maddie being Secretary of State? Only girls are Secretaries of State." And in her lifetime, most of it's true.
Now, the eagle pin that we talked about earlier, I don't know if you want to repeat that story because you have told it a number of times, but it was hanging in the wind swearing in.
It was so funny because I did go get it, especially for the reason. And so when I was being sworn in, I had put the pin on, and there I am standing with President Clinton and Vice President Gore, and one hand on the Bible and one hand up in the air. And I look down all of a sudden, and this pin is just swinging around because it was an antique pin with a very complicated clasp. So after all of that, if you look at the picture, you can't see the pin. But I was afraid it would fall on the Bible and it would ruin the whole oath. And so it was an issue. But anyway, I now know how to put it together.
My guest is Madeleine Albright, who served as U.S. Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001 and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations from 1993 to 1997, the author of a number of books, the bestseller Madam Secretary, for example. And her most recent is a book of a different sort. It is larger format because it's got a lot of pictures. It's called Read My Pin, Stories from a Diplomat's Jewel Box, and it is published by Harper. When people started catching on that you were wearing these pins, did they start giving you pins?
They did. And what was interesting is I got a number of pins from fellow foreign ministers. So, for instance, I got a wonderful British lion head from Robin Cook, who was the foreign secretary. And a number of pins from various Russians, Primakov and Igor Ivanov, and from Foreign Minister Vedrine and Javier Solana. And so those are very treasured pins. And then people give me pins. And now what's happened is because my pins have been taken away and they're in the exhibit, I now get what I call pity pins. People are saying, you've got to have something to wear. So people have been very nice. It's just great.
Do you try to wear the pins that people have given you when you see them?
I do try.
This is like pulling out the bottle of wine that somebody
Absolutely.
Gave you.
Absolutely, and trying not to re-gift, you know. But no, I do try. I really do try. And people appreciate it, and it's a lot of fun.
What about the other way? Do you give pins?
I do. What happened was there was a group of women foreign ministers. I'm kind of like to create support groups. So when I was secretary, I got them together. At a certain period, there were, I think, 13 of us, and I got an eagle pin that I signed on the back, and that's my signature pin. And so I gave it to them, and I'd give them to some of my very favorite women friends.
Hillary Clinton has been a close friend of yours, and now she has your old position, the third woman in a row, in fact, to be Secretary of State. Has she called you for any advice?
Well, we're really good friends, and so we do talk. And we talk about what a great job it is and all the challenges. I think that this administration has the most stunning amount of challenges to deal with, and it is very nice to be among those that are consulted.
Does she wear pins as well?
She does occasionally,
but
I think it's a little different.
Well, a listener asked why you think that people, for the most part, don't wear pins anymore. Things have changed. When I was young, women wore hats. Men wore hats as well. You could almost guarantee that a woman would be wearing some kind of decorative brooch. And now it's quite rare. Or it's only certain people, perhaps of a certain generation.
I think maybe it's funny because yesterday at the I was at the Museum of Arts and Design, and some young women came up, and they said, "This is so great. I think we'll start wearing pins." So we'll see. I think things have kind of become a fad or something. But Michelle Obama wears pins, and she is so beautiful and tall that she can wear pins in a very elegant way.
There's been a lot of focus on what she wears. Why do you think people are so interested in what she and other women in government wear?
Well, I think that what the first lady, any first lady wears, I think becomes a statement. And I grew up in Washington when Jackie Kennedy was the first lady, and she set a whole style. And I think Michelle Obama, because she is young and a very active young woman, she has set a certain style, and American designers appreciate having a beautiful first lady. And so I think that happens. It's a little bit different for women that are in official positions. And in that regard, it's a little irritating, I have to tell you, because people focus sometimes on what you're wearing rather than what you're saying.
Yeah,
and
they don't do it for men.
That doesn't happen to men.
Nobody is saying Barack Obama is wearing a Brooks Brothers suit, or he's wearing a suit that he had made for him at Dunhill or whatever.
No, and I think that what happens, it happened to me, is, you know, my hems were either too short or too long. I never wore pants because I didn't look good in them. And the one time I did, when I was going on actually to the ranch of the president of Guatemala, I was criticized for wearing them. And yet they are the most practical things for somebody that has to get in and out of helicopters or sit on stages to wear pants.
So over the course of your career, you had to start thinking about what might be considered appropriate dress?
Believe it or not, I mean, you do have to think about it. I mean, what happened was Jean Kirkpatrick had been ambassador at a period before me. She was also a professor at Georgetown, and while we disagreed on policy issues, we were good friends. And before I went to New York, she said, look, Madeline, you've got to get elegant clothes. You can't wear your professor clothes. You have to get... So it gave me a good excuse. But basically, you do have to kind of look the part because you are in official pictures. I have to tell you, though, a funny story. We were at a big NATO celebration in France at a certain point, and I was having a very long conversation with the German foreign minister sitting next to me. And all of a sudden, I looked down, and I had spilled salad dressing all over my skirt. And after that, I thought, well, if this had happened to Henry Kissinger, he would have had on a dark suit. Nobody would have seen it. What am I going to do? This is a disaster. And so all of a sudden, then they came to me and they said, you have to be in the middle of the family photo. And I thought, what am I going to do? Hold the menu in front of me? So I tried to figure out. I had on a skirt, and it was loose enough for me to turn around. And so when I got up, I switched my skirt around, and I was very glad it wasn't one of those with a slit up the back. So there are problems about women's clothes.
And you could not have done that with pants.
Definitely not. So that was the advantage.
Yitzhak Rabin's wife, Leah, gave you a pin that you've worn quite frequently. What is it, and what does it symbolize?
Well, it's a beautiful dove, and she did give it to me because of the need for peace in the Middle East, and I wore it whenever I gave a speech on the Middle East. And then on one of my trips to Israel, she gave me a necklace of doves, and she said one dove really needs reinforcements on this issue. And so I wear it a lot. It is on the cover of my book that I wrote about God and religion and foreign policy, and The Mighty and the Almighty. And I also wore it when I went to Rwanda to honor those who had died in the genocide or killed in the genocide.
When you were Secretary of State, you had to deal with nuclear arms threats from Pakistan and North Korea. Did you wear special pins? Did you have bomb pins?
No, but when I went to North Korea, one of the stranger visits of all time, because we didn't have an ambassador there, and I wanted to make very clear that I was there with a purpose, and I wore a very, very large American flag.
And Kim Jong-il, did he notice?
Well, he did notice, but what I noticed, it was so... If you look at the picture of that, it's on that same crazy room where President Clinton was with the scenery of the rugs and the waves. And we had our first press conference, and I saw that Kim Jong-il and I were about the same size. And I knew I had on high heels, and I looked over, and so did he. And his hair was a great deal poofier than mine.
Were you surprised when North Korea freed Laura Ling and Una Lee, the two American journalists who had been sentenced to prison for illegally crossing into North Korea? Did it take somebody like Bill Clinton to do it? Did they need somebody who was that prestigious?
I think they did, and I gather that they made that very clear. And I think that it was an important visit, and I think that it began a process where the North Koreans, there's discussion now, the Chinese have been there in order to get them back into the multilateral talks.
A listener wants to know what you make of all the controversy over Sarah Palin's expensive wardrobe. Because she probably was given the same kind of advice that Jane Kirkpatrick gave you.
Possibly, but I bought my own clothes.
They weren't on loan, and
right.
and then you didn't just keep them.
Yeah, right.
The annual United Nations General Assembly debate concluded yesterday. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think any significant progress is achieved?
Well, I am a believer in the United Nations. It's an imperfect organization, but it is a place where countries can talk to each other and listen to each other. There is a certain it's interesting. I teach, and I just had a discussion with my class about this, and as to whether what happens when you have somebody like Gaddafi or Ahmadinejad speak, or you have the same rights for some very small island nation. It does show that people are entitled to say and be listened to, and it does allow for interchange. The General Assembly session itself is only kind of a first act to what happens in the United Nations. The big meeting, and the important one, I think, was the one that President Obama chaired in the Security Council on nonproliferation.
Did you think it was appropriate for some delegates to walk out during Ahmadinejad's speech?
Well, that's your right. I mean, if you are being insulted, you can walk out, and people can do that. They walk out of a number. It's kind of a symbol of not wanting to listen to tirades.
What about falling asleep during Muammar Gaddafi's speech?
Well, it's perfect. I don't know how anybody fell asleep. It was such a scene.
But it went on forever.
It did go on forever, and I do think I was surprised by the fact that he did something like that, because I think he was beginning in some way to rehabilitate himself, and I think that he hurt himself and Libya, and I think it was a truly ridiculous scene.
This morning on Morning Edition, a former Bush administration diplomat said that he really thought that any direct conversations with Iran would be fruitless because they just simply won't go along with anything. What are your feelings about
that?
Well,
I think it's worth trying, because part of what happens here is you cannot make a point saying we need you to do this or these are your responsibilities unless you talk to somebody. And the thing that I have found really quite short-sighted is when people say that talking is appeasement. It is not. You have to deliver tough messages. And the other part, I think, we learned something, at least I hope we did, on the whole Iraq run-up. What happened was President Bush actually won a great victory in the Security Council when the inspectors were let back in. But he didn't run the game out, run the string out, so that if they refused, then we would have international legitimacy for taking stronger action. And I think that the Obama administration is being very smart in terms of gathering international support, trying to explain what is going on, giving the Iranians a chance to explain what they're doing, and then keeping their toolbox, their options open.
In 2006, you said that you feared Iraq would be the greatest disaster in American foreign policy, worse than Vietnam. You think that's true?
Well, I think that the unintended consequences of it are something that concern very much. First of all, I think that the war itself really did hurt America's reputation very badly. And you have the issues of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and how it is that America behaves. And I think President Obama and the administration is trying very hard to restore our image. But I also think that one of the unintended consequences is the question you asked before, and that is the rise of Iran. I think in many ways you could say that Iran has benefited the most from the war in Iraq. And it's hurt us very badly in the region. That doesn't mean that now there isn't some progress, but I do think it is a disaster.
Although Iran has been wounded, obviously, by the protests over the election outcome there, now people are saying that Afghanistan is going to be the next Vietnam. I guess every time the United States gets involved in that kind of war, we wind up with a comparison to Vietnam.
I don't think it's valid to compare everything to Vietnam. I think Vietnam was a horrible experience for the U.S., and Vietnam and quagmire become kind of synonymous. And I know, for instance, when we began to take action against what was happening in Kosovo, people would say it was another Vietnam. Vietnam was a very special situation. I do think that we have to be careful about what the strategy for a war is, what the objectives are, knowing where we're going with it. But I don't compare things to Vietnam that much. I do think the reason I said Iraq was worse is because that had been such a searing experience for the U.S., and it was a long time ago, but I was really troubled by what the war in Iraq had done to America's reputation and those unintended consequences.
Madeleine Albright was the 64th Secretary of State of the United States. She served from 1997 until 2001, and during that time, and previously when she was at the U.N., she wore a lot of pins. And she's written a book called Read My Pin, Stories from a Diplomat's Jewel Box. It is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much, as always. Thank you.
If you'd like to see some of Madeleine Albright's pins, they're on display at the Museum of Arts and Design through January 31st. That's at 2 Columbus Circle. Up next, Dr. Nicholas Christakis and Dr. James Fowler explain just how much influence our friends can have over our lives, from our emotions to ideas and even our health. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.